morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. And here's what we have coming up for you this morning, for the remainder of the morning until noon. Right off, we have political perspectives. Today, Linda Olsen-Osterlund welcomes Andrea Williams from CAUSA to discuss deportations, ICE raids, DACA, and Oregon driver's licenses. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary, and then at 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock, the Recovery Zone talks to solar energy specialist Jesse Hunter, who wants to dethrone King Kong, that's C-O-N-G, coal, oil, nuclear, and gas. And please let us remind you that KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved when you go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. You can become a member there, and we appreciate it. And let's listen to a couple of announcements, or just one announcement, before we get to political perspectives with Linda and her guest, Andrea Williams from CAUSA.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
The crops are all in and the lettuce is rotting. The oranges are piled in their creosote dumps. They're flying back to that Mexican border to pay all their money and wade back again. My father's own father, he waded that river. They took all the money he made in his life. They rode on that truck till they lay down and died. Goodbye to my Juan, goodbye Rosalita. Adios, mis amigos, Jesús y María. You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane. And all they will call you will be deportees. Some of us are illegal and others not wanted. Our work contract's out and we've got to move on. There's 600 miles to that Mexican border. They chase us like outlaws, like rustlers, like thieves. We've died on your hills and we've died on your deserts. We've died in your valley.
Good morning and thank you for tuning into KBOO Portland and to Political Perspectives. That song was Joan Baez singing the song Deportees, which is the perfect entrance to our show today. I'm bringing you a guest. Her name is Andrea Williams. She's with Executive Director with CAUSA Oregon. Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So glad to have you here. I want all of you out in the audience to know you will have an chance to join the conversation as we get towards the halfway mark, I will tell you that the phone lines are open and you can start calling in. I want to let you have that phone number right now if you'd like to write it down. It always makes it easier for you when the time comes. It's 503-231-8187. And today's topic, as you can see, I think we pretty much made a big deal of it, was we're talking about Latino immigration since Trump, and we're talking about DACA, the Dreamers Act, we're talking about the Oregon driver's license, we want to talk about the ICE raids that have been taking place here, because you know, so much stuff is happening all the time right now to grab our human rights interest or our political interest. And I wanted to make sure that the issue of immigration and people from Mexico and other Latin American countries have its day on the air, so you be sure and hear it and keep it in your mind. And so for that reason, I reached out to Andrea Williams. I had seen her at a press conference before and felt she could speak well for this. I want to tell you just a little bit about CALSA. It's the Oregon's immigrant rights organization founded in 1995 by farm workers, Latinos, and immigrants, and other allies in order to defeat ballot measures that would have negatively impacted the lives of Latino families in Oregon. They work in our state and on national levels in coalition with other organizations to advance issues that impact the daily lives of Latino immigrant families. And some of those issues include what we've been talking about, actually reform for immigration, driver's license laws, access to higher education, economic justice, health, and equity. So this is an organization that plays an active advocacy role, works directly with its population, and works in lobbying and trying to change the legal framework that immigrants live under here in Oregon. So welcome, Andrea, again. Tell us a little bit more about CALSA and why you're part of it.
So thank you so much for the opportunity to share more about CAUSA's work. For those of you who are wondering, what does CAUSA stand for? It means cause in Spanish. Our roots as an organization come from the farm worker movement. And so back in those days, they would say, que viva la causa, long live the cause. And that's where the name CAUSA comes from. We were founded in the 90s by multiple farm worker advocates who are at the time were facing year after year ballot measure attacks in our own state here in Oregon at the very same time in the 90s when the LGBTQ community was facing some of the same attacks as well. And so we come out of this long lineage of histories of organizing farm workers, low-wage immigrant workers, and today we work hand-in-hand with the farm worker union, PACUN, as one of our sister organizations.
So you're really in there on the ground working with people, and at the same time, you're trying to make changes in the laws, in the structure of laws. Can you talk about one of the current battles? There's an initiative that's going on that you guys are fighting?
Sure. So, you know, as a state-based organization under the current Trump administration, what we've attempted to do for many years, but especially this year, is look at how can we improve life in Oregon for immigrants here. And it's never been more true that local change has truly made the most impact, and where we have seen the most progress this year in a really difficult national environment. So we knew ever since we lost in 2014 Measure 88, some of you will recall that Oregonians largely rejected by 67% the idea that undocumented immigrants should be able to drive in our state. That ballot measure was organized by an anti-immigrant organization with ties to the white supremacist movement. They're called Oregonians.
No real surprise, is it, though? I hadn't heard that.
Right. They're called Oregonians for Immigration Reform. They've been around almost as long as CAUSA, local anti-immigrant activist group. And they essentially referred the driver card law that we passed to the ballot in 2014 where it lost. Sure enough, they were emboldened by this win, and they came back in 2015, 2016, trying to qualify new initiatives to the ballot. CAUSA and our partners mobilized quickly. We created the One Oregon Coalition so that anti-immigrant initiatives would never pass again in Oregon. And we successfully prevented three anti-immigrant initiatives from making the ballot in 2016.
Wow, that's a lot of work.
So that included English only, E-Verify, and voter ID restrictions that could have been on the ballot but didn't make it to the ballot thanks to our organized effort. But of course, shortly after that, President Trump was elected, and our local anti-immigrant organization continued. They thought it was their opportunity to forward Trump's agenda in our own state. And so they currently, their current initiative is called Initiative Petition 22. They're trying to qualify it as a ballot measure in November 2018 for the midterm elections. And it would repeal Oregon's 30-year-old sanctuary law. That essentially says local law enforcement cannot use its personnel, equipment, or resources to enforce federal immigration law.
And so we saw, about a month ago, Jeff Sessions, our not esteemed attorney general, head of the DOJ nationally, come here to chastise Oregon law enforcement and to, I think, appeal to the parts of law enforcement that would like to be tougher on immigrants. And within, I think, 7 or 8 days, we saw some raids happen around the nation, and we saw direct action protests at one of the ICE facilities, the one that's here on Southwest Bancroft and McAdam. Talk a little bit about what does it mean to be a sanctuary state, and when, and how much does that help us, and what are the limits of that, so that a Jeff Sessions can come here, have his speech, and begin to see more aggressive enforcement happen as a result of that?
So let's first back up a little bit. Sure. About why Oregon became the first state in the nation to pass a sanctuary law.
Oh, I hadn't known that.
So Oregon, up until recently, was the only state in the nation to have an entire statewide law. Other cities like San Francisco, New York, LA had similar policies, but not on the state level. Oregon passed this law in 1987. It passed with nearly unanimous support. There were only two votes missing out of the entire 90-member legislature. And it was completely bipartisan. And Oregon legislators said at that time that we needed a law that was restricted our local resources from being used to essentially do the federal government's job, which is immigration enforcement. Because what was happening in the state at the time was that local law enforcement was arresting U.S. citizens that they thought were undocumented. So they were racially profiling farm workers, Latinos.
A sort of local Sheriff Arpaio, if people want to remember the Arizona sheriff that was famous for targeting
right.
Latinos and arresting even legal residents and naturalized citizens at times.
Right, and local law enforcement didn't have the tools or the training to really know how to enforce federal immigration law. There's a lot of training that goes into that type of position. And so they were making mistakes left and right, and it was a huge liability for the state. And Oregon believed that we were better than that, that we believe that we shouldn't treat people differently based off the color of their skin. And so the Oregon legislature said, hey, it's a resource issue, but it's also a discrimination issue. And they passed this 1987 law, commonly known as a sanctuary law, but the actual statute is 181A820. And at the time, nobody was talking about it as a sanctuary, right? That term actually didn't come about until much later, until these days. It's much more politicized. But back then, it was really seen as a resource issue, as limiting local government's role in federal immigration enforcement, and that was it.
And some of us might remember that there were churches and others that stepped in when there were raids that might have been, I remember one in an agricultural facility north of here in Portland, but on this side where a lot of women were arrested, and then they found out, oh, they have American children, they have children born here. And so they were given a stay to not leave, but they weren't allowed to work. They didn't have a legal status to work here. And churches went out of their way, and other organizations went out of the way to sort of protect them. And at some, I had always thought of sanctuary, meaning, you know, I'm a church or a facility like that, and I close my doors on law enforcement and protect the people who've come inside asking for sanctuary. But that's not really what these laws or, and now there's like 12 states, I believe, that have sanctuary state laws. That's not really what that law is it?
Right. So the what we commonly call a sanctuary law or a sanctuary city is really just saying that city or county or state resources, county buildings, local law enforcement, libraries,
the facility up the gorge, the right. facility here. In-
so cannot be used to enforce federal immigration law when a person's only violation is that they're here undocumented. Now, there are exceptions if somebody has committed a local crime for local police to then communicate that with federal immigration agents. There's quite a few exceptions to that. And so for these reasons, it's, you know, the word sanctuary, I don't think accurately describes these laws, but it's what is commonly known in the media today.
And it's certainly better than nothing. It means that our local law enforcement isn't going to be helping to select and draw out these. You know, since Trump, I tried to get some numbers out of ICE and just doing some research, and I didn't call them directly, but I was looking on the web to find any, and I wasn't able to find anything more recent than, say, May. Do you have a sense of how many people they've been deporting? One of the one thing that I read was a national response, and it said that arrests were up 38%. This was last May, but deportations were down from under the Obama administration. Do you know anything about that? Do you have any sense of what's actually happening here in Oregon in terms of how many people are being picked up for deportation and how many are actually being taken away?
Well, so numbers with Immigration Customs Enforcement, known as ICE, is really difficult to find. And they're an extremely opaque agency. It's very difficult to get an honest or straight answer out of that agency. And so it's very hard to find local numbers. But what we do know is that arrests and deportations have increased as compared to the Obama administration in previous years. And keep in mind that the Obama administration is known for deporting a record number of people. So we're already seeing this year under the Trump administration an increase in arrests and deportation. And we expect that to continue given the executive orders that President Trump released earlier this year that basically said ICE has no priorities, which means that anybody who is here undocumented is at risk of deportation. And certainly what we've been seeing is ICE looking for a particular individual, but running into others that they perceive to be that individual, racial profiling, questioning them, and then arresting them even though that wasn't the person they were originally looking for. In other instances, earlier this year, we saw two vans of farm workers who were up at 6 a.m. They were getting ready to go pick flowers for the flowers that you see at Fred Meyer in your bouquet. And ICE pulled over that van. They claimed they were looking for two of the individuals in that van, but they ended up arresting all 12 of the people in those vans. And that's called a collateral arrest.
Mm-hmm. Just because you're with someone they're wanting to arrest, so they
wrong place, wrong time. They ended up being indigenous Guatemalans whose second or third language was Spanish. And so we ended up interviewing many of them, finding, connecting them with lawyers and through translators. But you can imagine how complicated that situation is.
Yes, and many of the workers who come here to work literally in agriculture do speak other languages. Their first language is not necessarily Spanish. Some of them have experience with Spanish. Some of them have very little because they're not coming from a Spanish-speaking area where they come. And I have worked with farm worker organizations, and it takes a lot of finessing because you're wanting to assist them in the same way, and yet you're having this translation difficulty. And it's not all that way to easy to find someone who speaks. I always say the language is wrong, but Mixtec, or there are other languages that if you don't know them, it's not the same. It's not Spanish.
Right. So these are the types of things that we're seeing. These are the types of stories we've seen all year, where people who have come to the United States in search of a better life, to provide for their family, to go to work, to raise their kids, are now being targeted for deportation, being separated from their families, having to pay exorbitant fees to be released. And it's creating this crisis in the community. When one family member is arrested and detained, it takes away a breadwinner, an income earner. It destabilizes an entire family.
And sometimes they fear that they have to move, leave their location, and there are moving costs because they fear, like, maybe a father was picked up. They don't want their mother to be picked up. I've interviewed one DACA person where their greatest concern was not for themselves, but for their parents who had brought them here, and not wanting them to be picked up as collateral if they happen to go after DACA workers. That's something I want us to talk a little bit more about the Dreamers and your guys' work with the Dreamer situation and what's happening right now. I want to let the audience know you're listening to Political Perspectives on KBOO Portland. I'm Linda Olson-Osterlin, your host. We're talking about Latino deportations, immigrant rights, and who I have with me is Andrea Williams, Executive Director of the organization CAUSA, which is an on-the-ground and in-the-lobbying halls organization supporting immigrant rights here in Oregon, Latino immigrant rights. Let's talk a little bit about the DACA law and the Dreamer law. These are young people who worked hard and signed up, and a law got formed that allowed them to stay here legally for a period of time. Can you talk about the DACA law? What's been the change, and what are people anticipating happening with that? I know you guys have worked with them a lot.
So I would first like to say that after almost over a decade of undocumented young people organizing and asking for the DREAM Act since early 2000s.
And that's where that name, the Dreamers, these are children who dream the American dream. They want education and ability to get a stable life here.
Right. We often refer to undocumented young people as Dreamers. They organized, they conducted civil disobedience. And once Congress failed for the 10th, 12th time to pass the DREAM Act law, President Obama came forward and said, I'm going to establish an executive order which provides temporary protection from deportation and a work permit for certain undocumented young people, and they would have to reapply every 2 years. And so that was the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, which was established in 2012. So recently we just celebrated 5 years of this program.
And the people I've met who are Dreamers, who are officially have signed up for DACA, boy, they worked hard to get there. They didn't just keep their nose clean in terms of criminal. They worked hard in school. They had jobs, everything to be the best citizen they could be here, to be able to get to stay here.
Right. So who are we talking about in terms of who is eligible for DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals? These are people who are under the age of 30. These are people who had to demonstrate that they've either served in the military or graduated from high school or gotten their GED. These are young professionals. These are students and their parents at this point, right? It's not just high school students.
Sure.
It's not just college students. But at this point, people have fought for so long in the DREAM Act that they're now parents in and of themselves. Mm-hmm. They're young professionals. They're working people. And so it's been, DACA has been a huge opportunity for people to work in Oregon, to have a work permit, and to have a driver license with that. And it's created...
Those two things are absolutely central.
Bread and butter for people. Yeah. Bread and butter for people's daily lives. It's made a huge difference. Of course, it wasn't enough. We need a long-term solution for that. And at this point, that's what we're fighting for. So September 5th, President Trump ended the DACA program very cruelly, ended it and said, Congress, you have until March to pass a permanent solution. And of course, that has that has created a lot of anxiety, instability, and also outrage within
feeling,
the Dreamer
feeling
community.
Feeling betrayed. I do want to get in there that, you know, I know there was a fear ahead of time before signing up to become an official DACA person and go through that process. There was the fear that we're giving all of our ID and telling all of our personal secrets to a government that's not necessarily been on our side and that's becoming more and more militarized and surveillance-based. Is this going to put us at risk in the future with a different president? And so now we're here. We're that question. Is there any basis, you think, for them to fear that because they're on this list, they will be easily targeted by ICE? Or do you feel like there's been enough protests that that will not be the way the government goes with this?
Well, it's really hard to say, you know, to predict what this administration is going to do. But I'll tell you one thing. Earlier this year, during the spring, we did see two DACA recipients get picked up by ICE. That was Francisco Rodriguez Dominguez and Emmanuel Ayala Frutos, two Portland area residents who had DACA. And they were picked up by ICE. And so, you know, they were targeted for other reasons. One had a DUI, the other one had a very small misdemeanor. But for all intents and purposes, we thought that they would be protected. And unfortunately, that was not the case. And time will tell. All I know is that every day, you know, that Congress fails to pass the DREAM Act, another person's DACA expires, right? These are 2-year permits,
right? And so they're coming due,
and DACA recipients no longer have the opportunity to renew. That deadline came and gone. That was October 5th of this year. Nobody can renew their DACA. So people are in this limbo. They want to continue their careers. They want to contribute to the community. And yet they find these barriers that the government
may actually be in college, and this would create an immediate stop for that, wouldn't it? Because they would no longer have the correct paperwork to be able to go through.
Well,
school.
So students can continue going to college. The question is, how are they going to pay for it? So undocumented students are not eligible for federal financial aid. They are eligible for some state.
I mean, they can't be enslaved by loans from banks, like most of the young people that I know.
Well, or even some scholarships.
There are
some stipulations.
And grants,
on,
of course.
Right.
Yeah.
And so they are eligible for some state-based financial aid, but it's very limited. And so if you're not able to work, it becomes extremely difficult to pay really high tuition costs.
And if you're not given that right to a driver's license in states that don't allow driver's licenses for people who are undocumented, that presents a real problem because every time you drive, you're taking your life in your hands, not because of a car wreck, but because of the potential for a minor traffic crime that could then be the one nail in the coffin of whether or not they come and select you to go. We'll talk more about the way ICE is operating here and what we hope and what you and other organizations are planning for as we move towards March. But I do want to give people out there in our audience a chance to call in, and we're running to about the halfway point. So once again, this is Linda Olson-Osterlund for KBOO. It's our Political Perspectives program, and I'm here with Andrea Williams of CAUSA, and we're talking about Latino immigrant rights and all of the changes that have been taking place under Trump. And so I want to let you have that phone number so that you can call in and become part of the conversation. There's so many different aspects of this that I'm sure you have questions and comments about. So that phone number is 503-231-8187. I'll say it again. It's 503-231-8187. Call in and have a chance to talk with me, but talk with the expert as well about all of these issues that I know many of you care about. I'm going to go ahead and bring up the issue of us not that, you know, in 2014 taking away the right for undocumented people to have driver's licenses and how that impacts lives in a very real way and how it impacts us as a larger community in the sense of how we're treating our maybe that's our neighbor, maybe that's the person we always meet at where we go get our groceries or, you know, there's so many ways that we interact with Latino immigrants every day, you know, in friendly, normal interactions. Maybe they're the mother at a daycare center we're bringing our child to as well. So talk about how that's being, that not having a driver's license, not being able to legally have a driver's license, how that, you know, shreds at your life when you are in that circumstance.
So the way that I think about these issues is, you know, on the national level, we have work to do, of course, right? We have to pass immigration reform with a path to citizenship. We need to pass the DREAM Act that allows a citizen path to citizenship for undocumented youth. And that's all the work that we have ahead of us. And of course, we've been doing that for decades. And at the same time, at the state level here in Oregon, we have a lot of work to do ourselves as well at the state legislature as Oregon voters. And certainly the driver license issue is really one of the top issues among the Latino immigrant community in terms of what can the state do to support and protect immigrant families. That is one of the top number one issues that needs to be addressed. Unfortunately, Oregon as a state has wrestled with this issue for a long, long time, starting with Governor Kulongowski back in 2007 and 2008, when a largely Democratic legislature and a Democratic governor said, you know what, undocumented immigrants shouldn't be able to drive legally in our state.
And I think that it feeds into a whole narrative about people who don't have documents for coming into the country are illegal, therefore they're criminal, therefore they're somebody we can look askance at, not want to know, not want to protect, not want to help. I think just the way we language it is a real problem in terms of gaining public support. But I do know that when people meet their neighbors, they generally want to support them. So I think there's a strong other current. We'll see how we can do with that. Right now, we do have someone on the line. It's Karen. Karen, thank you for calling in. Are you there, Karen?
I've been working with a group called Emerge, and we've been demonstrating at ICE and went to NorCor not too long ago to demonstrate and taking on other actions. I am particularly interested in asking you, Andrea, how we can help out with fighting against IP 22, if there's any way that we could work with CAUSA. I'm not speaking for Emerge as an organization. I'm just a little individual member of Emerge. But I wonder,
which makes
if
you
there
important,
were a way to partner with you to cooperate in some way so we could be more effective. Just really love to hear your answer.
Absolutely. Thank you. And Emerge, Interfaith Movement for Immigrant Justice, is a huge partner of CAUSA's, and they are also a member of the One Oregon Coalition, which is the primary coalition fighting back against IP22. And so some things that people can do to support a no vote on IP22, you know, especially for Emerge, who works in the faith community, you know, it's a great opportunity to talk to a group of people who care about sanctuary, but we're collecting pledges of support. We're building our list of people who we can count on to volunteer, to vote no on IP22, to take action in some way. So we ask everybody to help us collect pledges. You can go to the oneoregon.org website and find that pledge form online. In addition to that, we have community presentations that is really a way to educate our base about where initiatives like IP22 are coming from and what people can do about it to take action. And so I would invite everybody to check out our website, contact us through that, and help us spread the word, really. You know, one of the advantages that we have right now is we have, you know, multiple months before an initiative would qualify. Our opponents have until July of next year. And we have between now and July to educate churches, to educate supporters of our organizations about what IP22 is and who's behind it. And I think that's the number one thing that we can do to help it right now, because we are part of the hard part about a ballot measure is you have a limited amount of time to talk to voters.
They have unlimited funds to oppose local organizations, because nationally the right wing has made, I think as part of their white supremacy really, has made a lot of stuff about they're going to be the ones to stop this and change things and get rid of all those immigrants. So they spend a lot of dollars. That's not the same way that we on the other side can do it.
Right. And so we rely on grassroots participation and community support. So again, the two goals that we have right now to prepare ourselves for success against IP22 are collecting pledges of support from individuals that are part of our organizations and conducting community presentations. And we have all of those materials, and you can contact us through the oneoregon.org website.
Okay, thank you. I also think part of our education has to be not just that people are coming here, quotes, for a better life. I think we need to emphasize the ways in which people are exploited as part of the workforce, that they're being used. We need to emphasize wage theft. We need to talk about how corporations benefit from having a group of workers who are, quotes, deemed illegal, and how that helps to keep them powerless. We need to talk about what our foreign policy has done and what our corporate policy internationally has done to force people out of their countries of origin. I think we have to do a lot to say this is not just a bunch of people coming up here for, quotes, our way of life. It's what is our way of life?
Yeah, it's a way, and where are the morals at the center of it? It's really very complicated, but I think you're right, Karen, all of those issues we need to bring up. One of the things I wanted to mention is that, you know, there's also people taking direct action, like attempting to block at different ICE facilities, including I saw one in New York in April. There were 1,500 people that blocked the Washington Bridge on behalf of Latino immigrants. And so I think one of the best things is that we need all kinds of organizations and all kind of organizers. And so I'm really grateful for the direct action people, for the protest, for the people that give us the context of how do these kinds of laws come to be in the type of system we live in. So, yep, thank you very much, Karen. We do have another caller. Yeah, thank you a lot. We have Allie on the line now. Good morning, Allie.
Hey, I have a question. I don't know if it's exactly on topic, but I've heard that some people are afraid to like perform daily tasks, and the only one I can currently think of is like grocery shopping and things like that. And I was wondering if either of you knew of any way that I could like help somebody go grocery shopping or like do those daily tasks for them so that they don't have to like live in fear and without.
Actually, the prior caller with the Interfaith Movement for Immigrant Justice, I know they have an accompaniment program where people sign up to volunteer to either accompany someone that needs support going to like a court appointment or fears ICE targeting them or helping with other daily tasks. So I recommend that you look up the Interfaith Movement for Immigrant Justice. I know that they have multiple volunteer opportunities in that regard.
What's their shorter name if she...
Emerge, IMIRJ. It's an acronym for Interfaith Movement for Immigrant Justice.
Interfaith Movement for Immigrant Justice. You know, there are also some other organizations that are mutual aid organizations that are around Oregon that, where you can directly support people in a mutual aid movement and work directly with the people that you're supporting in that movement. You know, everything from collecting food and clothes to back to school campaigns and helping people work with our legal or our medical system. And I think... thanks a lot for asking the question, Allie, because I think that's exactly, you know, that's the heart we want to appeal to when we hear these bad ballot measures coming and when we try to talk people into understanding why we need to have a driver's license law here that provides for immigrants who've come without regard to what their, quote, legal status or illegal status is.
Yeah, and I'm definitely going to be checking out your website so I can try and figure out how to get involved with the IP22 ballot measure. So thank you very much for the information.
Excellent. Thanks. We look forward to working with you.
Yeah. Right. We don't have any other callers right now. Let me give you that number. It's 503-231-8187. I want to ask you, you know, about, you know, saying people are afraid to go out and do some of their daily tasks. Well, we've seen some really nasty tactics from ICE, including approaching people that appear to have been racially profiled, and they've shown up at courthouses and at daycares, and they show up in unmarked vehicles and without any ID and say they don't have to give any ID. Can you talk about some of those occasions that you know about and how ICE is operating here in the state, especially when, you know, are you going to let a stranger come up with no ID and haul you off somewhere?
Right. So in Oregon, at least, ICE has been operating in plain clothes. That means jeans, a sweatshirt, a hoodie, walking shoes.
And there'll be mixed gender groups. And like
yeah,
three
females,
people.
Males together in unmarked vehicles. They've largely been lurking outside of courthouses, which is considered a public space, and a few blocks away from schools. They will pull people over off on the side of, you know, who are driving in the streets. And it's really difficult to identify who they are. And so there's been...
They could look like parents of their students at your kid's school. You know, they're just there in a car, an unmarked car.
Right, and that's
intentional. A man and a woman.
Right, and that's intentional. They intentionally dress so that you cannot tell who they are or where they're from or who they're with. They do carry a badge around their neck. Sometimes it's hidden under their sweater or their sweatshirt. But there have been really scary instances where people feel as if their family member is being kidnapped because they have no idea who this person is and why they're arresting their family member or why they're taking away their child. So there was this one instance in Woodburn, for example, that happened a few months ago. It was a family of 10. ICE knocks on their door. The family answers, and they're looking for a man that no longer lives at that house. And the family said he doesn't live here anymore. In fact, he's in jail. ICE proceeded...
Obviously, one part of law enforcement not speaking to another.
ICE proceeded to attempt to take away the infant from the mother's arms.
Horrifying.
And the family calls 911. They're terrified. They don't know who these people are. Somebody's trying to steal their child. Woodburn police shows up, and they mediate the situation and ask ICE, you know, what's going on here? Who are you? Identify yourself. And ICE identifies themselves and says, we're looking for this particular individual. And the police says, well, if we look through the house for you, will you go away? And so that's what the Woodburn police did. They looked into the house. They didn't find the individual, reported that back to ICE, and ICE left.
I want to really thank those Woodburn police because they were doing the right thing in that circumstances rather than the wrong thing. And I think there are, of course, many policemen who always want to do what they consider the right thing. But, you know, that's the kind of behavior we appreciate. I believe we have another call on the line. Hi, Jaime. This is Linda. You're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Thank you for your show, and I wanted to just mention a couple things. I had helped build some of the Pecoon facilities back in the day, and I remember a court case where we arrested a farm worker for alleging murder, and then he was tried and convicted and sitting in jail for many years when we finally found out he doesn't speak Spanish, and, you know, he didn't do the crime, but he was more scared about going home, and he was sort of okay about sitting in the jail.
So he went through a whole process with no one bothering to find out that he was not understanding the Spanish spoken by the translator.
Yeah, we could look it up on the computer. It was in the 90s. So it was a real famous case here in Oregon.
Wow. Well, thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, I don't think that that's probably the only time that's happened, as a matter of fact.
And it draws the point that the person was so concerned about going home that they would even allow themselves to go through the system falsely for fear of you know, going home.
Yes, and a lot of people come to this country for a lot of different reasons. Some people do come for economic salvation, basically. Where they are is they cannot find enough work to be able to keep their family alive. And so they, you know, especially after NAFTA, I did do some work with an organization and I was out in the fields. And I remember one woman I worked with had a broken wrist. She had farmed corn in Mexico and cattle. But after NAFTA, she could not afford to farm either of those anymore except just for food items for their own family because they couldn't compete on the market. We were flooding, Mexico with cheap beef and stuff like that. So she came up here. She paid a coyote to get up here. She worked in the fields for less than one week, and she broke her wrist and was presented with a hospital bill of over $1,500 for setting that wrist. And she had no idea what to do or where to go. And no way to go home, even if she could just go home and try to make it work there and be with her children. So we know that people come from circumstances like that, but we also know some are coming from like Honduras, where there's extreme violence in communities that people are trying to get here to save their lives, literally, to save their children's lives or their own lives. Parents sending children without adult accompaniment, not because they're bad parents or they don't care if their children are safe, but because they are desperate to get them to safety. So the circumstances can be all over the map about why people come here, but it's never, I think almost never trivial. Never just, I feel like going to a foreign country and getting a job.
Thank you. And for a merchant marine like me who's been 44 countries and who's studied history and seen everything, I just published a dissertation I'll make a plug for, and it makes some very good legal arguments for what our last rights and remedies are in this stage of where we are. It's published at PDX Strider, PDX Strider at WordPress.com. Send a hard copy to Pekun already. I'll send one out to some of the other organizations, and keep up your good work.
Yes, well, thank you very much, Jaime. We appreciate it. And we do have another caller on the line. I believe we have Tim. Hi, Tim. Are you there?
Am I there?
Yep, you are.
Okay, hi. Hey, I'm a former Peace Corps volunteer, and I worked with small, poor farmers in Paraguay, Chile, Honduras, Costa Rica, and in the United States on reservations. And so I look, and I was an organizer and as well, and I always look at things in long term, right? For the families that came up undocumented or outside the system, they knew they were taking a chance, but they knew about what they had instead was worse. So they took the chance in the hopes that things would work out better for their kids. And they did work out better for their kids. They were right? But they did go under the table, if you don't want to say illegally, but they did violate the customary procedures, and therefore we have the situation. And so but the kids in the meantime, they did gain a lot. Even if they end up back in Mexico, they've gained a lot. And the solution, I believe, to stability, population stability and stuff, is that the people of whatever country should have a decent chance at life in that country, a decent chance of justice and equality. And that doesn't come by leaving the country to go live somewhere else. I see that some of these dreamers, if they decided to take it upon themselves voluntarily, if they were to return to Mexico, they could become the core of a gigantic movement of change that could bring stability, democracy, freedom, justice, land reform.
Well, I hear what you're saying, Tim. I hear your point, and I want to let Andrea have a chance to respond.
Sure. I mean, I would say I would reframe how you're looking at this a little bit. I hear what you're saying, but also for the dreamers we're talking about, this is their home. This is how they identify as being Oregonian or American in every form except for the paperwork. This is in many cases where they have grown up since they were infants or small children, and this is where they want to stay. And so the idea of dreamers voluntarily leaving, I mean, that's an individual choice that each person will have to make. But exactly. The stories that I've heard, the people I've interacted with, this is their home.
And I think one of the other issues, Tim.
I'm not saying that every dreamer would.
Right. You're saying if a grouping of them.
Some of the dreamers would still have an affinity to Mexico, their ancestral homeland, or maybe Guatemala, or whatever it may be.
Let me say something about this, Tim, because I talk to people from Mexico as well, and I have a really close friend who is a long-term resident here, legal resident. And, you know, people also leave their countries for issues of corruption And yeah. and specifically, I'm talking about police and government correction. And so
exactly.
What sounds like going back to their country to form an organization to really make the difference, I think it's a bit idealistic, because I don't think it's that easy to organize yourselves within a state that's that corrupt. And also where many places, you know, the state has allowed and the state police have allowed narco-terrorism, really, like the state of Guerrero or this wonderful city, Veracruz, this old port city that's beautiful on the other side of Mexico. And that has been made completely unsafe. And so when young people, well, let me talk about it this a little bit more, though, Tim, because when I've talked to parents of DACA people, they're extremely fearful to send their children back to the area of Mexico they came from, if it is Veracruz or Guerrero. So it's a complicated issue, but I like your idea, and I want to thank you for letting us hear it, and we'll go on to the next caller.
Okay, have a good day.
Thank you, Tim. Bye-bye. And our next caller is Bruce. Bruce, thank you for calling. Oh, I'm sorry, Ruth. I was taking your name away entirely. Ruth, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I think it's very interesting, the topic that is being, you know, discussed today. As a woman, as a young woman of Mexican descent, who was born in the United States, but my parents were not. You know, this is the land I was born in. I grew up in Mexico for the first 7 years of my life until I came here, and obviously, I can relate a lot to what everybody else is saying. And I just wanted to bring up the fact that, you know, Mexico is a very interesting country, and specifically the politics and just the mentality that goes on. And I think that when people come to the United States, you know, what they're looking for is obviously a safer environment, because in Mexico, even just a couple of years, 2007, there was mass murders going on through the drug wars, and obviously they were aided by the government, and you couldn't trust the police. If they stopped you, they could rob you, they could practically do whatever they wanted with you. As a first, you know, hand experience that I have with, you know, being Mexican and also being very close to Mexico, not just, so I've known people that have been, you know, murdered in my own country, and I just think that why is it that Mexicans specifically are the ones being treated this way, when a lot of European immigrants came here not too long ago, you know? So it's just a very interesting, very interesting.
Yeah, you know, thank you. Let's let, you know, Ruth, I think, you know, why do they go instead of European ones is I think racism underlies it. And I also think that we've wanted to use Mexican laborers as disposable, come in when you pick the crops, go away after that. But let's have Andrea talk about what you're talking about. And thanks for calling, Ruth.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, so I would just say, let's not forget that we have a white supremacist as a president. Okay.
That's
and
right.
So every immigration policy that or immigration executive order. We also have an attorney general, Jeff Sessions, who is a well-known anti-immigrant Congress member in the past. And so when we think about what kinds of policies they're trying to craft around immigration, it's really targeting immigrants of color. When you look at the ending of TPS, Temporary Protective Status, recently they just ended TPS for Haitians, and they're looking at different Central American countries.
60,000 Haitians losing their, I believe it's 60,000 losing their legal right to stay in the country just by executive order.
Right, and the administration is giving them 18 months to return home. And, you know, these are largely countries that have been devastated by earthquakes, by natural disasters, by civil war. And so
imperialist policies of other nations like Spain and France.
And so in many instances, there may be no home to go back to or relocate to. And so when you look at the kind of policies and how they're implemented, we're really talking about targeting immigrants of color. And to me, it's a part of that white supremacist agenda that our president and his administration is trying to move forward in our country.
And I think they use these kind of executive orders to like strike another blow into the immigrant community to make them feel more afraid and actually take action that can take them away and move them out. But also just to appeal to their base. I mean, he openly appealed in a racist manner, as far as I'm concerned, during his campaign about who should be thrown out, and really basically painted all Mexicans coming here as rapists and murderers. It's just the most absurd thing. So, yeah, we're up in a big battle is what we're in. We're up in a big battle, and a lot of it's public relations in the way that we need to actually convince the public, and they have money and we don't. So it takes all of our grassroots efforts. And people like you, Ruth, I hope you'll, you know, I'm betting you do your part in these struggles one way or another.
Absolutely. You know, being an American and being Mexican, I grew up in El Paso, Texas, which is a border town right on the tip of Texas and Mexico. So I grew up with lots of Mexican culture in an American city. And so when I moved to Oregon about 2 years ago, that's when all the questions about race and like what I was started coming up. And I was quite shocked because I never grew up around racism in the United States, in that specific area. So coming to a northern state and a northern city, which is, you know, very open about politics and discussing race and everything, I was just kind of shocked as to, you know, everything that I experienced being a person of color, you know? And also, I have German ancestry that migrated to Mexico in the 1940s when when Hitler was in power. And so just thinking about why people go to different places and how they're treated afterwards is just really interesting to me. And obviously, you know, when the Germans came to Mexico, the Mexicans let them in.
Yeah, exactly. They didn't build a wall.
Exactly.
Well, and I think too, what you're talking about, your experience as a woman of color in Oregon, and certainly I can relate quite a bit. I'm multiracial. You know, it's Oregon has a long history of racism. Yes. And racist policies that mm-hmm. have kept communities of color, particularly Black people, out of the state of Oregon. And it's institutionalized, it's systemic, it's also one-on-one individual. But when you look at Oregon's history over time, we've preferenced and passed policies that are exclusionary of various immigrant communities, of various communities of color over decades. And so I think
maybe 100 years, like the Chinese Exclusion Act. And
right, and we used to have sunset laws where Filipinos and other Asian immigrants couldn't be out past sunset, otherwise they would be arrested or even shot in some wow. really bad cases. So I would say, you know, I think today's experience is connected to all of that, and certainly we have a long way to go in Oregon to improve our state and to be the most inclusive as possible.
Right. Well, I'm very happy that radio stations like these still exist. You know, KBOO. I listen to it every morning, and I really love the educational, you know, information that you all provide. And I would just say thank you.
You're welcome, and thank you for saying that. You know, I'll just get it straight in here, a plea for funds. We are going to be having a fundraising a drive starting November 28th, and any of you who also feel that our station is really important, know that it's funded by you. It's all individuals, and that almost everybody you hear on the air is either a visitor to the station as an expert or a speaker, as Andrea is, or is a volunteer who learned their radio skills here at KBOO Portland. And thanks a lot, Ruth, for your call. I really appreciate it. I want to really thank Andrea Williams of CALSA, for coming today. I do want to say, Andrea, we will stay in touch, and I will keep my eye out for all the activities you're doing, including signing that pledge of support. Can you give people a couple places like One Oregon to where they can relate to this and they can join the struggle a little more?
Yeah, I would just encourage people to take action and to get involved in local organizations. I mean, there's so many here in the Portland area. I'm sure many of you are aware. There's, of course, Unite Oregon that works with multiracial communities. There's CAUSA. You can find us on the web, causaoregon.org.
CAUSA.
You know, there's other groups like VOS, who works with day laborers.
Picun.
And APANO, the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. And we work in close partnership with each of these organizations who work with immigrant communities from a variety of backgrounds, API community, Muslim community, also the LGBTQ community with Basic Rights Oregon is very involved. You can find a list of our partners at the oneoregon.org website and sign up there. You'll get alerts from us. And we just welcome everybody to get involved and take action.
All right. Well, thank you, Andrea Williams of CAUSA, and thank all of you callers. You were each and every one interesting and brought valid points. That's what I love about call-in radio. And I want to thank Tammy Dean, who is our wonderful engineer there, facilitating all of these calls. I know there was one more caller on the line, and we weren't able to get you. I'm sorry about that, but we will have this topic on again. And just thank all of you listeners for KBOO Portland. This is Linda Olson-Osterlund signing off.
Goodbye to my one, goodbye Rosalita. Adios, mis amigos, Jesús y María. You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane.
It's 10 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Thanks to Linda and Andrea for that great interview. Next up, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary at 10:15 Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And then at 11 o'clock, we've got the Recovery Zone today, talking to solar energy specialist Jesse Hunter, who wants to dethrone King Kong. That's C-O-N-G, coal, oil, nuclear, and gas. Stay tuned for all that coming up on your community radio station, KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring for a project manager to help organize our 50th anniversary celebrations in 2018. We are looking for someone who can help